Hello, survivalists. This is the Crux True Survival Stories. I'm your host, Casey McIntosh, and today I have Julie Henningsen as usual. How are you doing today, Julie?
Doing great, Casey. Excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. I have a little bit of a different take on our episode this week, where we're just going to do something a little bit more light than what we've been doing lately and hopefully get everyone interested and curious about some of these things that maybe we don't think about all the time. So today's theme, I'm going to go through a list of questions, and I'm going to ask Julie if she thinks these questions are true or false, and then we're going to go over the maybe unexpected answer. Any thoughts about that, Julie? Are you ready to be put on the spot?
Oh, I am getting put on the spot. I did not know that's what we were doing today until this moment, but I'm excited. I'm ready. I'm feeling up to the task here, and I'm excited to do something different. This is kind of a fun approach.
Yeah. And I mean, I have a good feeling that probably you're going to answer these questions mostly correctly. The idea for this episode came from this book that I just recently purchased called The Survivors Club. And I think it's going to be really interesting. I haven't had time to sit down and read it cover to cover yet. But when I opened up the first page of the book, there was a section of questions for true or false. Okay, so here we go with our true or false question. Let's get started. Question, true or false? The safest seats in an airplane are in the back.
Okay, I think I might know this from the episode not too long ago about Eddie Rickenbacker, who was a pilot. And I think he said he was going down in a plane wreck. He knew he was going down, so he got up and went to the back of the plane because that's the safest place to be. So I'm going to say true.
Yes, you're right. Studies have shown that passengers in the rear have the higher survival rate in crashes. So nice work, Julie. One out of 10.
Okay, nice work, Eddie. Thank you, Eddie Rickenbacker.
Passengers apparently can do a few things to improve their survival chances. The British Airways Flight Training Center in West London has some recommendations for you. So the first one was make a plan. When you board a plane, you should be looking around your environment, identifying the nearest exits. You might not be able to see them if the cabin is filled with smoke. And then the other thing, too, even though we're so bored when they do this and you just want to bash your head against the wall or the window a little bit, is to listen to the pre-flight safety instructions and look at the seat back safety card, because different airplanes have different instructions. And I'm with you. I know that this is the most boring thing and it's usually hot in the airplane and you're just like, let's go. But just consider for a moment. I think the big thing is where is the exit is probably the most important thing to know. The other thing, too, is to dress appropriately. So wearing long sleeve shirts and pants increases your chances of staying warm in the event that the plane crashes. And you don't want to be wearing heels because you are going to have to remove heels if you're going down the emergency slide. And obviously, heels are not practical in an emergency situation. You're really going to be hating yourself if you're, you know, stranded somewhere in a pair of heels, I would imagine, for most of us.
Which makes me think, like, what situation are heels practical in?
Right. Basically none.
Probably none.
Did you know that heels were a thing that men did back in the day to make themselves taller?
Oh, that's...
Yeah, so like the...
Oh my gosh, that's so
the fancy men used to wear heels. But yeah, I don't know when women took them over, but totally unrelated to survival. But at some point, maybe I'll bring that back. This is just such a torture device for women, you know?
Right, yeah.
Okay, so the next thing is fasten your seatbelt. Make sure that you know how to get it off, because oftentimes people have trouble unbuckling their seatbelt. I think it's in a situation where you're stressed and you're not thinking clearly. The seatbelt on an airplane is not like the car seatbelt. And so it might not automatically translate how to remove it when you're stressed. Andy Club of the BA Flight Training Center said that it's been found that people who have survived emergency landings frantically search for where they expect the seatbelt to fasten on the hip. So anyway, just be aware of the fact that it is different and, you know, just something to consider. The next one is to check for your life jacket in the plane, but don't inflate it until you're about to get out of the airplane. In an Ethiopian airline, Boeing 767 off of Comoro Islands near Africa in 1996, there was a crash and people were inflating their jackets in the cabin. They weren't able to get out of the cabin when the cabin flooded because they had the life jacket on.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Right. So anyway, you might want to just wait. And then the last thing is to brace yourself for impact. The goal is to prevent being propelled forward rapidly. So you want to put your seat in the upright position, which they're going to tell you to do that anyway, to lower your head to your knees and rest it on the seat in front of you and put your hands behind your head, but not interlacing, and keep your elbows by your head and to keep your feet as far back as possible from the seat in front of you. Just in the event that seats are moving, you don't want your legs to get crushed. So it's not like you have a lot of space to move your feet, but just something to keep in mind. Hopefully none of you listeners ever have to survive a plane crash on a commercial flight, but you know.
I feel like it would be hard for me to bend over at the waist and tuck my head between my knees and put my hand, you know, like that's not a position of like alertness.
Right.
But so, yeah, I would not intuitively do that. But knowing that that's the thing to do is helpful because maybe now I would.
Well, and also you're not going to be able to get your head all the way to your knees because you don't have that much space in the seat. But I don't know. It'd be interesting
to
see how mechanically that's helpful. You know, if the seat in front of you moves towards you, maybe it's just so your head isn't flying around and you're kind of protecting your head and your neck.
Yeah, a little more stable. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this next one I just think is really interesting, and I haven't done a lot of research to see, you know, why this might actually be the case. We'll get there. Question two, true or false? If you suffer cardiac arrest in Las Vegas, you're more likely to survive than you are in many hospitals.
Okay, that's a good one. If you said Seattle, I would say true because Seattle has the best EMS system in the world. But Las Vegas, that's just an odd thing to ask. So I'm just going to say true.
Well, you're right, Julie.
Okay.
You're actually correct.
Went with the instincts on that one.
So apparently Las Vegas has a high rate of bystander CPR and defibrillators. So there you have it. But I guess here's the thing. Do people actually know how to use these things? I know they're prompted, but a lot of people don't even know that you can go find this device that should be in most places, like at Costco. If you're at Costco and somebody goes down, they've got a defibrillator somewhere. So it's all about knowing that those things are actually available, because if you don't know that it's in the building, it's not going to do you very much good.
Yeah. So a public safety announcement: in most airports, if not all, defibrillators are spread through, and probably other public facilities, spread throughout the facility generally so that there are no farther than a 1 minute walk from wherever you are at any point in time, which means that theoretically, if somebody goes into cardiac arrest, they could be connected to a defibrillator in, you know, 2 minutes, which that kind of time frame yields pretty good survival rates.
Right. And probably the big thing here is the fact that you get early intervention as opposed to waiting for someone to respond. The question is, if you're in the hospital and there are defibrillators everywhere, why are you having less survival than if you're having a heart attack in a casino in Las Vegas? That's what I don't know.
Yeah, that's where it says some hospitals. You get better survival than in some hospitals. I guess there's a few out there that you don't want to check into. You might not check out.
Right. Maybe it's that sometimes when people are having cardiac events, they're not being monitored at that time, at that moment in time, or maybe, I don't know, or it's secondary.
Yeah. If they're in the hospital to begin with. Right. Exactly. There's probably a bigger picture host of issues going on that would lower their survivability in the first place.
Right. Like if you're in the ICU with a double pneumonia on a ventilator and then you have a heart attack.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. Like your chances of survival at that point are less. Yes.
Yeah. So, that makes sense.
I mean, the best thing would be not have a cardiac event, period. The next question I thought is interesting. Question number three, true or false? If you fall into a frozen lake, you only have 3 minutes to escape.
Oh, I love this question. Okay. And I know the answer. I'm going to probably go on a rabbit hole with this. So 3 minutes to escape. I'm going to say that is false. And here's what I know about that. And my knowledge on this subject comes from Dr. Gordon Giesbrecht, who's a pretty well-known physiologist, I think at the University of Manitoba, where it gets very cold. He has studied this stuff. He's hired graduate students to drive snowmobiles across the ice, knowing that they would fall into the water, and study how they escape. He's done it himself. Put him in holes in the ice and tried to sense his own body temperature and his ability to kind of self-rescue. And this is what he came up with that stuck with me. When you fall through the ice, you're in freezing cold water, you have 10 seconds to get control of your breathing. So you focus on just getting control of your breathing, calming any hyperventilation that wants to happen because of that cold shock. Because some people do that, they just instantly drown because their breathing is erratic. So 10 seconds to get control of your breathing. And then once you have control of your breathing, you have 10 minutes of meaningful muscle movement, which means you have 10 minutes to try and actually like pull yourself out of there. Like you maybe use your arms to push yourself out like you would get out of a swimming pool, or hike your leg up over the edge of the ice, or find a escape route. But after 10 minutes, you're going to lose the ability to use your own muscles. The cold will kick in and disable that strength. And you have 1 hour, 60 minutes, before you would be in the window where you would die of hypothermia. So your objective at that point is just to keep your airway above the water, keep breathing so you don't drown. But it actually takes about an hour, you know, minimum for your core temperature to drop enough to actually cause a death by hypothermia, which is way longer than most people would think.
So you're saying in the event that you couldn't get out of the water within 10 minutes?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you could, the 10 minutes of trying to get out was a failure. Then what you should do is take your now limp, useless arms that are wet and just sort of plaster them on the ice in front of you if you can, so that they freeze onto the ice. And that, you know, contact, that frozen contact might help hold your head above water. And then your job is to just hang out and wait for help, hope for help, knowing that you could hang out like that for an hour if you had to.
Wow, that is really interesting.
Yeah, Dr. Gordon Giesbrecht, he's one to Google. He was on the David Letterman show years ago. He's just known for doing these crazy experiments with lowering body core temperature, bathtubs of ice, willing graduate students, and pretty entertaining.
What you need in that instance is like a crampon for your hands, so you have some more traction, a hampon.
Yes, a hand pond.
Just very, you don't want them on your hands as you're driving your snow cat. But I mean, once you're in the water, it would be really very useful.
Yeah. Yeah. They'd have to like eject the spiky part ejects only when needed. Oh my gosh. We're stumbling on a good invention here, Casey.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like Wolverine.
Oh, okay. Hugh Jackman.
I think possibly Wolverine has something similar to that, but I don't know for sure. But yeah, that would come in handy for a lot of different reasons. Like if you were being attacked.
Okay. Yeah.
You know?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So next question. You already know the answer to this one. This is an easy one for you, being a Montanan. Question number 4. True or false? You should play dead if you encounter a bear.
Okay. It depends on what kind of bear. If it's a grizzly bear, you should play dead because you stand no chance. And they might just like bat you around a little bit and get bored. But if it's a black bear, you shouldn't play dead. You should get big, make yourself big, increase your body profile as much as you can, raise your arms, look a little threatening. And they might actually be threatened by you and leave you alone. I think that's the prevailing wisdom. Am I right?
Yes. And then the other thing that I would be thinking about, Julie, is how do you differentiate a black bear from a grizzly bear for those people who don't live in, you know, big sky country?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's good. And I think there's some really specific indicators. For me, it has a lot to do with where I am geographically. Like I know where grizzly bears are and where black bears are. And then, of course, size is obvious. Size is one. Shape of the snout, size of the feet, color, I think even plays into it.
Although they can be multiple different tones. Even black bears can be brown.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think at different stages of life and different factors can affect fur tone throughout one grizzly bear's lifespan.
Right.
One thing, being a Montanan, you would say this too. I've encountered enough grizzly bears and enough black bears on my adventures that, you know, it's a kind of a no-brainer once you know, more of an intuitive decision. But I will say my first bear encounters in the wild, I was a field forester for a number of years up in Northwest Montana where you live. And ran into a lot of black bear during that time, just out on the job day to day. And what I noticed is I could always smell them long before I could hear them or see them. So I knew I was headed into a bear encounter because I'd pick up the scent like a wild animal.
Right.
But they have a distinct smell.
But don't they all smell bad? Like all black and...
Yeah. I don't think I can differentiate a grizzly from a black based on the smell. But in either way, it makes me turn and walk the other
direction.
You're
like a bear connoisseur. You're like, grizzly bear for sure.
A very refined nasal palate.
Right. Well, and this is completely ridiculous for me to say this, but I think that black bears, they remind me of a stuffed animal where you're like, they're so cute. And grizzly bears have the hump.
They are cute.
Right. You have the hump.
The hump, yes.
And they also just look way more foreboding. Like if that thing came, and their claws are a lot longer, right, than black bears.
Yeah. And their prints, you can, their tracks, mm-hmm. you can tell the difference by the kind of size and shape. Yeah.
And grizzly bears, I don't think are climbing trees, whereas black bears are frequently climbing trees. So that might be something that could key you off. But in any case, just don't have a bear encounter. That's a good thing to avoid if you can.
Yeah.
Okay. So this one I have kind of mixed feelings about, but question 5, true or false, it's safer to drink untreated water from a fast-flowing river than from a stagnant pond in a survival situation.
Okay. Yes. I mean, I would say I think that that is true. And I'm not saying I know that that's true. I just think it. And maybe this is a myth, but I think it because of like the turbidity of the water. All of the junk or debris is going to settle out a little bit more in the faster moving. So you're getting more clear water.
Right.
If you take it from where it's moving fast and near the surface.
Right. I think that that is true. I think this answer is true and false just because you might find some faster moving water, but potentially depending upon the size of the water body, you might have a dead deer that's just 100 yards above the stream. And if that's the case, you're SOL. So in terms of where animals are dying in the forest, you might actually get more exposure to some pathogen that are unknowing. And even though it might look clean and it's moving fast, it doesn't necessarily mean you're not getting Giardia or some other horrible pathogen from that water source.
Yeah, I hear you. And that's a good point.
Yeah, one thing that I was finding is that sometimes stagnant ponds, they can be contaminated for sure too, but they have exposure to sunlight and some other natural filtration. So potentially you might be okay drinking from the pond. I think in general, if you can avoid drinking water when you're out in the wilderness, unless there's really no other option, is not a good idea. That's what we could say.
Yeah.
However, if you're at higher alpine environments, your likelihood of finding cleaner water is higher because you're getting snowmelt. And it's less likely to be contaminated by human and animal waste compared to lower elevations. But again, I mean, water should be purified if you can, either way.
Yeah, yeah. I think of like a fast moving stream through like a cow pasture. I don't care how fast that water's moving. That is not
a safe
water source.
Yeah.
But yeah, the high alpine where the water hasn't had the opportunity to be exposed to a lot of human or animal toxins on the way to you.
Exactly.
Is the best possible scenario.
When I worked for the Forest Service, I did trail work. And the person that I worked with, he was my boss. He drank water out of basically any stream you can imagine. Mm. And when you have a boss that's doing that, you're like, he's drinking that water. It's probably safe for me. And I mean, I drink water out of places I never, ever should have had water. And that was a long time ago. I would never do that again. And I think I just got lucky because sometimes like we had a family friend who had Giardia and his stomach was never the same. It never, ever really recovered.
Oh, I've had Giardia. See, this is Murphy's Law. You've drank questionable water and never had a problem. Well, I have never. I mean, I am a water filtration, I am on top of it. I would never have done that in the past. Yeah. And I ended up with Giardia years ago. It's no picnic.
Oh, no. Do you feel like your gut recovered fully?
Yeah, my gut did recover. I took metronidazole and I was back on my feet.
Oh, that's
good. That stuff was a lifesaver for me. It took me a while to figure out what was going on, though. It's my lowest adult body weight. I lost a lot of weight. But yeah, once I got the treatment, I was back to normal.
Well, and the thing too is that it's not like you can avoid all things. You know, if you take antibiotics for a dental infection, then you get C. difficile, so which is probably worse than Giardia in most cases. But in the urgent care, I actually saw this kid, they have some of the wilderness schools for challenged kids or kids that have gotten into trouble. And I saw one of them. They had done a camping trip and the kid came back and had high fever and GI symptoms, and turned out that he had some type of pathogen that thankfully we were able to identify. Some of these pathogens you're not even actually treating. Once you know what it is, it's just supportive care in a lot of the instances.
Yeah. Yeah. Like salmonella or campylobacter.
Right.
I guess.
Boiling water obviously kills bacteria and viruses and parasites. You want to boil for at least 1 minute or 3 minutes if you're at higher altitude. The other thing too is water purification tablets. And you can use these tablets or drops that can contain chloride dioxide or iodine to effectively disinfect water. And those are things that can fit into a day pack. And it's probably just a good idea to have them. The other one, portable water filters, so you can remove bacteria or protozoa viruses. And then there's UV water purifiers too. I had one of these light pens, but I don't know. I mean, the hard thing about that is that you don't definitively know that all of that stuff in there is dead. And so I questioned the use of one of those things, but that's just my own personal psychology.
No, I think that's valid. I think, you know, there's so many factors, the temperature of the water, the exposure time to whatever agent it is that you're using, the fineness of the filter. And there's a lot of claims that, you know, are worth sorting through. And depending on where you're going to, are you getting water out of a high alpine stream or a place where you are worried about primarily bacteria, protozoa versus...
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
As viruses, those are a little less common in a lot of places in the world, but a lot more common in other places in the world.
Right. Okay. And so then you can also collect rainwater, and rainwater is generally safe to drink unless it's been collected from polluted surfaces. So having something to catch water in could be helpful. And then if you're at high altitude, you want to melt snow or ice over just trying to eat it, because eating snow takes a lot of energy and it's going to reduce your core body temperature versus melting it first. I guess the main takeaway that I had from all of those things is that, hey, it's easy to throw some iodine tablets into your backpack when you're going backpacking or when you're going hiking. And that way, at least you can reduce your risk of being exposed to some of these things that could make you really regret life later.
Right. Yeah, that's easy.
Okay. I was surprised by this. I guess I shouldn't say that to you. Now you're going to already have an idea of what the answer is.
Oh, okay. I'll strike that from the record.
Okay, strike it from the record. Question 6. True or false? In prisoner of war camps in Vietnam, optimists lived longer than anyone else.
Oh, that is 100% true.
Not according to the Survivors Club.
Of course. I am very... Okay, yeah. You saying you're surprised by that makes me say it must be false, but I also am surprised by it. So tell me more.
Okay, so the overly optimistic often suffered more because they had hopes that were repeatedly dashed. So I guess the whole thing is realistic optimism is more beneficial.
Okay.
I almost think that in some instances, people that are overly optimistic are not really feeling optimistic. They're just projecting that.
Trying to convince themselves that they're feeling optimistic, trying to talk themselves into it, but not truly feeling it.
Exactly. Maybe. That's what I think.
Oh, yeah.
But I could be wrong. Yep. That's my assumption.
Okay.
Question 7. True or false? You can survive 3 weeks without food, 3 days without water and 3 minutes without air.
I've always thought that is true.
It is true.
I mean, there's definitely, okay, good. There's some variability in there, but yeah.
Right. Like if you are already undernourished, you're probably not going to make it for 3 weeks without food.
Yeah. And then you hear these stories of people making it 7 weeks without food. Right. Some of the stuff that we've talked about on this podcast, or 3 weeks without water.
Yeah. And I think, you know, depending upon the water situation, you know, if you're in the Sahara Desert, you're probably not making it for 3 days without any water. If you're completely exposed to the sun and the elements. So, yeah, there's probably variability in that. Okay. I know that you're going to know the answer to this one, but some of our listeners might not. Question number 8, true or false? Drinking alcohol can help you keep warm in a cold environment.
I'm going to go false. It would have the opposite effect.
Right. Because it creates a sensation of warmth, but it's dilating blood vessels. And because you're getting dilation of blood vessels, you're having a reduction of your core body temperature. Because that's how your body cools itself off, is by dilating blood vessels. So it would actually increase your risk of hypothermia. Not a good idea, people.
Yeah. It might make you feel warmer, like in your periphery, but it would chill your vital organs more quickly, which is how it would lead to hypothermia, I'm guessing.
Right. Okay. Question number 9, true or false? The survival rate in airplane accidents is less than 13%.
Okay, that's a good one. And I don't know much about this. Less than 13. You hear about people that have like survived multiple plane crashes. I bet it's higher. I'm going to say false.
Nice work, Julie. You were crushing this quiz.
Nice.
So yeah, the survival rate is actually over 95%, according to the National Transportation Safety Board.
I wouldn't guess that high.
Right? I know, but surprising. Because you usually hear about the stories where the plane goes down and like all of the passengers on a commercial flight die.
Yeah, or at least most.
Well, yeah. I would think that most of the crashes that are happening are probably not commercial flights then in that instance, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably like small craft, little mishaps where the plane's wrecked, but people walk away.
Exactly.
That probably happens a lot more than we realize.
Right. Okay. So this is the last question. I know you're going to get this answer right because you're a PA and because you're Julie and you have all this experience. By the way, pulling that thing out about that guy that researches cold stuff, like,
impressive.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
That was not a setup. It just coincidentally happens to be an area of interest.
Well, I'm impressed. I'm sure everyone else is impressed too. That's why you're perfect for this podcast. Okay. Question number 10. True or false? In extremely hot weather, drinking water alone is enough to prevent heat stroke.
That's false.
Correct.
Heat stroke is not a hydration problem. It can be, but it's primarily not a, well, yeah, that's, it's because I'm a PA. It's primarily not a hydration problem. And I'll let you take it from there.
Heat stroke is caused by prolonged exposure to high temperatures. It's often a combination of dehydration, which leads the body's temperature regulation system into a point of becoming overwhelmed. And this can result from high environmental temperatures, especially with high humidity, exertion in hot weather, which can rise body temperature faster than it can be cooled down. Of course, dehydration, alcohol consumption can play a role because it can affect the body's ability to regulate temperature and can contribute to dehydration. Wearing excessive clothing, it doesn't allow the sweat to evaporate and can prevent the body from cooling down. And certain medication can affect the body's ability to stay hydrated and respond to heat, such as diuretics. Symptoms of heat stroke include a high body temperature, 104 degrees or higher, altered mental state or behavior, nausea, flushed skin, rapid breathing, and racing heart rate. Stroke is a medical emergency and requires immediate treatment to prevent serious complications or death. So obviously, staying hydrated is crucial when it's hot, but it's not enough to prevent heat stroke. And part of it is just exertional. You know, a lot of people are getting heat stroke when they're out practicing football in the summer temperatures with multiple layers of clothing on. So taking breaks in the shade and wearing lightweight and light colored clothing can be helpful. Avoiding strenuous activities during the hottest part of the day is important. I don't understand why, but like every day that it's the hottest day I've experienced, I'm driving around and people are out running. I'm like, I run.
Oh,
and I'm like,
I know.
What are you like? Why? I just don't understand why. It's cool in the evening. Why are you running when it's 90 degrees out? I don't understand. But in any case, gluttons for punishment. That's all I can say.
Whenever I get the urge to run in the heat, I just lay down and let the urge pass.
Don't you mean just like whenever you have the urge to run?
Yes. Whenever I have the urge to run, period. I take a recumbent position and allow the urge to pass.
Oh my gosh. By the time people hear this episode, I will have just finished a half marathon in Missoula. So let's hope that.
Yes, that's exciting. In the heat, it's July, June, July.
Well, I think it'll be fine because I have to get on a bus between 4:15 and 5:15, and the race starts at 6 a.m. So by the time I finish, which
that's
hopefully is not later than 2 hours, then it's going to only be like 55 or 60 degrees. So I think it'll be okay.
Yeah. Then you can go get a big breakfast.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Crux True Survival Stories. We hope you enjoyed this playful segment and learned something new along the way. Join us later this week when Julie Henningsen will be dispelling some common survival myths. If you enjoyed today's episode, please follow us on Instagram at The Crux Podcast for updates and behind-the-scenes content. And if you have any questions, feedback, or survival stories of your own, feel free to email us at thecruxsurvival@gmail.com. Until next time, stay safe and enjoy your summer.